and I, with my thoughts bent on the motivations of evil stepmothers, sit by the side of I-55, watching the Greyhound shake. Carl, after a hasty pullover, directed us off the bus, then waded shin-deep into what must be a week's worth of sewage. I stick my journal in my backpack and dare a glance around. My fellow passengers aren't staring daggers at me. They're staring scimitars. A trendy family of four in matching polos. A painfully ugly blonde standing at least 6'6". Two Japanese men in heated arguments. Jabba the Gut, his face in a starry sci-fi. The juvenile Brits. A little kid who looks like a Tolkien character. Poncho Man. And dozens of others, jabbering on cell phones, murmuring under their breath. Each of them pissed at me for interrupting their super-important journey to wherever. Are you keeping a diary of your travels, dear? Sweet Arlene, the Queen Arete of my odyssey, coils her veiny fingers around that wooden box in a death grip. Her purse she left on the bus, but not the box. Forgive me, she says, blushing. I noticed the journal, but I shouldn't pry. No, it's fine. It's a letter, I guess. She nods, and for a split second, I think maybe that's the end of it. To whom? She asks. I sigh and look up at the shaking bus. You wouldn't believe me if I told you. Arlene clears her throat in that way old people do, where you can't tell if it's a laugh or a cough or a life-ending gurgle or what. Would you like to hear where I'm headed? Happy for the change of subject, I nod. Independence. The land of autonomy, I whisper, smiling. She sort of chuckles, but her heart's not in it. It's a town in Kentucky. My nephew lives up there with his boyfriend. The way my head whips around, you'd think it was spring-loaded. Not that this is any big thing, but coming from Arlene, well, maybe she's not quite as leave-it-to-beaver as I thought. She looks sideways at me now, one corner of her mouth curling up ever so slightly. His name's Ahab. The boyfriend? I ask, smile squarely in place. No, my nephew. I'm not sure what his boyfriend's name is. I haven't met him yet. They opened a filling station, and it's doing quite well, from what Ahab tells me. Though he was a champion swimmer in high school, so I'm not sure why a filling station. But I suppose a man has to make a living. This conversation has taken a turn for the surreal. Arlene's gay nephew, a champion swimmer named Ahab, and his unnamed boyfriend have opened a gas station in Independence, Kentucky, and it's doing quite well from what old Arlene hears. I don't know what to say to any of it. I finally land on, good for them. Arlene looks down at the box, so when she speaks, it looks like she's talking to it. A while back, my younger sister, that's Ahab's mother, stopped answering his calls. We lived together at the time, and I remember he'd call 3-4 times a day, but she never answered. When I asked why, she clammed up, started crying. So I called Ahab myself, asked him what he'd done to make his own mother stop answering his calls. And do you know what he said? I shake my head. He said, Aunt Arlene, you wouldn't believe me if I told you. Arlene's tone changes. You don't have to tell me about your letters, Mim. They may be private, and if that's the case, you tell me to mind my own business. But don't say I won't believe you. You'd be surprised what I believe these days. I consider her story for a moment. Why'd your sister stop answering Ahab's calls? Arlene never takes her eyes off the box. You know, when I was younger, I thought if I lived long enough, I'd understand things better. But I'm an old woman now, Mim, and I swear the longer I live, the less things make sense. She pauses, sets her jaw, continues. My sister didn't approve, of the boyfriend. She never said so out loud, but some things speak loud enough on their own. For a full minute we sit in silence, watching the bus shake. It takes me that long to process the wisdom of Arlene. "I'll make you a deal," I say, pointing to the wooden box in her hands. "You tell me what's in there, I'll tell you who I'm writing to." Arlene smiles from the box to the bus. "I'm afraid I'd rather not talk about this anymore." I'm surprised how disappointed this makes me. And not just because I want to know what's in that box of hers, but because I think, deep down, I was ready to tell her about Isabel.
"Yo, Missy!"
Above the rear tires, Carl's head is sticking out of a little window, his eyes fixed on me. That tuft is looking especially frizzy.
"Come on in here,"
he says, disappearing back inside the bus. Every scimitar turns in my direction. I sling my bag over my shoulder, grateful for Arlene's supportive smile, and climb into the belly of the rocking beast. I've only known two other Carls in my lifetime, an insurgent moonshiner and a record store owner, both of whom taught me important, though very different, life lessons. In my book, Carls are a top-notch species. But easing down the aisle, listening to the grunts and gags of my third Carl, I'm beginning to wonder if this streak has ended. Girding my nostrils, my lungs, my everything else, I poke my head around the corner and gag. The stench isn't terrestrial. It's not even extraterrestrial. This shit, so to speak, is mega-terrestrial. Propped in the corner, a sopping mop leaks unidentified juices into a bucket. Carl's gloves are covered, too, and even though the floor and toilet are pretty well cleaned up, I bet all the cash in Kathy's can that this stink isn't going anywhere. It has seeped its way into the very framework of the bus. I clear my throat, announcing my presence. Carl's tuft skims the ceiling as he removes his gloves and tosses them into the mop bucket.
"Just want to make sure you ain't blind!"
My epiglottis flutters. Carl is unaware of the great blinding eclipse, unaware of my solar retinopathy, but... He lights a cigarette, takes a drag, and points to the sign above the sink.
"Read that for me, will you?"
Relieved, I read the sign aloud. "Use trash can for paper towels and feminine products. Do not flush."
"You notice those last three words?"
He sticks the cigarette out the window, taps off the ashes, and takes another puff.
"They big and bold, ain't they? So, I'm forced to ask. You blind?"
In the movie of my life, I flick that cigarette out of his mouth and educate him on the effects of secondhand smoke. Also, how to be nice. Carl is played by Samuel L. Jackson, and I, of course, am portrayed by Madame Kate Winslet. Okay, Zooey Deschanel, then. Fine, a young Ellen Page. "I'm not blind," I say. He nods, takes one last drag, and tosses the stub out the window, thus confirming my suspicions. Not all Carls are created equal. After stuffing the mops into a pygmy closet, he leaves me alone in the bathroom. I stare at my face in the tiny mirror and wish a thousand things. I wish we'd never left Ashland. I wish Mom wasn't sick. I wish we hadn't gone to Denny's that day. I wish Kathy would jump off a cliff. I wish I hadn't thrown away those letters. I wish I hadn't squandered my proof. I wish I still had a tangible, I don't know what, thing. I wish wishing were enough. But it's not. Sometimes you need a thing. Chapter 7. A Metamorphosis Begun.
"Mind if I sit here?"
A familiar smile shines down on me, sending my epiglottis into orbit. And like that, Poncho Man sits in Arlene's spot. My Arlene! He leans over, removes a pair of penny loafers, with actual pennies tucked in the front flaps, and slides them under his chair, next to my Arlene's purse.
Turning to me with jack-in-the-box enthusiasm, he offers a hand.
I never properly introduced myself, he says. I'm Joe.
Think quick, Malone. I point to my right ear and shake my head. I'm deaf. He drops his hand, but his smile goes nowhere.
We talked in Jackson.
The old Malone stick-to-itiveness kicks in. I turn to look out the window, pretending not to have heard. The rest of the passengers file into their seats. The engine rumbles to life, and the bus slowly gains momentum. Wherever Arlene ended up sitting, she'll be getting a purse delivery pronto. I might just camp out in the aisle next to her.
I've been watching you,
says Poncho Man. If there are four creepier words in the English language, color me a monkey's uncle. I watch the slowly passing trees out the window. You can't hear him, Mary. You're deaf, and you can't hear him.
Chit-chatting with the old lady and the bus driver,
he continues. If there were sand, I would bury my head in it.
I know you can hear me.
If there were wet concrete, I would bury his head in it. Antoine, I whisper, still looking out the window.
What's that?
My name. I turn to look at him. I want to see that phony smile wiped off his face. It's Antoine. Poncho Man, I will not call him Joe, does not relinquish his grin. In fact, is wider than ever.
Not a very good liar, are you?
Better than you, I bet. He sighs, sits back, and pulls a book out of his poncho. I didn't even know ponchos had pockets.
That's doubtful.
Oh yeah, why's that?
Because I'm an attorney.
While I look for his off switch, he goes on and on about his practice in southern Louisiana, which he runs out of a small condo, one he shares with his ex-secretary, now wife, and blah, 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 shoot me now.
You want to hear about my latest case?
I open my mouth into a wide, fake yawn, look directly at him, and blink slowly.
A while back, he starts, one of our biggest clients, you may have heard of them.
I pretend to search for something in my backpack for a full minute.
And not only that, they wanted to sue for, get this, fraudulent roofing. Hand to God, I can't make this stuff up. So anyway,
I sigh as loud as humanly possible.
Here's the best part. It was the mother's company. Can you believe that?
In the face of Poncho Man's unyielding torrent of absurd babble, I raise my hand.
Yes,
he says, looking somewhat amused. I'm sorry, but you seem to have missed the indicators.
Indicators?
He's smiling again, just like under the canopy back in Mosquito Land. God, this guy's a creep. I can't quite place the why, but I know the what. There's something there. Something more than just your run-of-the-mill obnoxious bozo. Either way, it's time to dole out a heavy-handed serving of honesty. Brutal and bold. Mim style. Yeah, listen, I really don't have the energy to point out each of the ways you've shirked the social cues of, well, society, so I'm just gonna say this. I don't care, man. I fake yawned, slow blinked, loud sighed, and pretend searched. I considered murdering you as well as a variety of suicides. Now I'm gonna put this in a way I know you'll understand. You stole my friend's seat, and I'd rather die than listen to you speak. My case, counselor, is airtight.
He's not smiling anymore. And my sentence, Your Honor? He asks.
I lean my head against the chilly window just in time to watch the sun finish its descent. A conversational restraining order. Arlene is unwittingly one hell of a saboteur. A few minutes after I issued Poncho Man's restraining order, the old gal stopped by to get her purse. Which would have been fine, except she used my name. About a dozen times. Mim this, Mim that, even a couple, how do you spell Mim agains, which I was just like, really? Needless to say, after she returned to her seat, my case for silence crumbled.
You a big reader, Mim?
Asks Poncho Man, flipping the page of his book.
Food for the brain and the soul.
The sun set a while ago. Most passengers are asleep.
but a few, like the idiot next to me, are reading with their overhead spotlights. It's raining again, even harder than before, which makes for an unnerving ride. The windshield wipers on a Greyhound are hypnotic, completely different from those on a car or a truck, like sandpaper on tile.
"So delusional," whispers Poncho Man.
His voice trails off, hangs in the air like a feather. For the first time since my closing argument, I look in his direction. The book he's reading is thin, the binding strung with a loose red yarn, frayed at the top and bottom of the spine.
"What did you say?"
I whisper, still staring at the book. He flips the cover closed and I see the title, Individualism Old and New.
"It's this philosopher," he says. "John Dewey. The guy is really chapping my ass."
It's not the same book. It's not the same book. It's not the same book. He holds the book toward me.
"You interested? Happy to loan."
Ignoring his offer, I turn to the window and search for the blurred landscape. But it's nighttime now. Too dark outside. Too light inside. All I can see is my own face. The sharpened lines of my jutting features. My long, dark hair. I am more opaque than ever. I shut my eyes, and in the pure nothingness, Poncho Man's book scrapes a vague childhood memory from the inner rim of my brain. Traveling through synapses and neurotransmitters, the memory is whisked into a delectable roux now ready to serve. My mother is sitting in her yellow Victorian reading Dickens. I am a tender age, 7, maybe 8. Walking around with a milk crate, pretending to buy groceries from our living room.
"And how much for the generic pine nuts?"
I ask in a feminine voice.
"Those are on sale for $82,
I answer myself gruffly. Dad, sitting at his roll top, assuming I hear nothing because of my age, peers over his Truman biography and frowns.
"You're not worried, Evie?" he asks.
"About what, Barry?" says Mom.
"I mean, look at her," whispers Dad, closing his book. "She's acting like a..."
His voice trails off, but Mom gets the gist.
"She has no siblings, Barry. What do you expect?"
Dad again, his frown more pronounced, his whisper more intense.
"This is exactly how it started with Iz. Voices and whatnot, just like this."
Mom closes her book now.
"Mary is nothing like Isabel."
My father opens his book again, buries his head in it.
"Your lips to God's ears."
"Mim?"
Poncho Man's voice pulls me back to the present.
"What?"
He raises an eyebrow and half smiles, apparently amused.
"You sort of went all catatonic on me. You okay?"
I nod.
"You sure? I could... I don't know, maybe there's a doctor on board or something?"
He twists in his seat as if a man with a stethoscope dangling from his neck might happen to be sitting behind us.
"I said I'm fine."
Poncho Man licks his thumb, leafs through his book.
"Well, good, because I was just getting to the good part. You're not going to believe what Dewey says next."
"I was just getting to the good part, Eve. Here, listen. Thought echo, voices heard arguing, voices heard commenting on one's actions, delusions of control, thought withdrawal."
My mother interrupts him.
"What are you reading?"
I hear the sound of Dad flipping to the front cover.
"I got it from the library. It's called Clinical Psychopathology."
I am 14 now, pressing my ear against my parents' bedroom door.
"That thing is bloody ancient, Barry. Is that yarn? It's falling apart at the binding."
Dad breathes heavily through his nostrils.
"That doesn't make it any less relevant, Evie. The guy who wrote it, Kurt Schneider, he's brilliant. Could probably think circles around Macandy. See, look, he's provided a way to differentiate between psychotic behavior and psychopathic behavior."
I lower my head to peek under the crack of their door. Mom's ratty slippers shuffle across the room.
"Psychopathic behavior? Jesus, Barry."
Dad sighs.
"I'm just telling you what I saw this afternoon."
This afternoon, Eric with a K broke up with me at lunch. Later, when Dad picked me up, I noticed he was acting weird.
"What you saw was our daughter upset over a boy," says Mom.
It's quiet for a moment, and then...
"Evie."
Dad's voice is desperate,
sad, soft. She was asking herself questions, then answering them, just like Isabel used to.
Okay, now I'm worried, says Poncho Man.
My misplaced epiglottis flutters, then calms, then flutters again. I pull my travel-size makeup remover from my bag and push past his knees. I can wait no longer. Walking down the center aisle, I hear the endless line of massive semis speeding by outside, kicking up giant bursts of rain. In the second to last row, Arlene is passed out on Jabba the Gutt's shoulder. He's reading a Philip K. Dick novel, unfazed by his seatmate's baby head. Inside the bathroom, I slide the latch to occupied. The light comes on automatically, flooding the tiny room with a sickly yellow tint, as if everything were suddenly jaundiced. In a grimy mirror, I watch as my dead eye closes. This still freaks me out, as my actual perception is unchanged. The only way I know my bad eye is closed is that my good one sees it shut in the mirror. Mom used to say how pretty I was, but I knew better. Still do. My features, independent of one another, might be considered enviable. Strong jaw, full lips, dark eyes and hair, olive-brown skin. The attractive pieces are all there, but jumbled somehow, as if each facial feature stopped just short of its proper destination. I act like I don't care, but I do. I always have. And my God, what wouldn't I give to put the pieces together? But I'm a Picasso, not a Vermeer. From my pocket, I pull out my mother's lipstick, my war paint. It's a black tube with a shiny silver ring around the middle. I try my best not to use it in public. Even with a heavy dose of makeup remover, a reddish hue is noticeable around the cheeks like a manufactured blush. But hue or no, I need this now. I start with the left cheek, always. This habit is king, and it must be exactly the same, line for line. The first stroke is a two-sided arrow, the point of which touches the bridge of my nose. Then, a broad, horizontal line across the forehead. The third stroke is an arrow on my right cheek, mirroring the first one. Next, a thick line down the middle of my face, from the top of my forehead to the bottom of my chin. And lastly, a dot inside both arrows. Even Picasso used a little rouge, I whisper. And then it happens. Chapter 8. Recall. Tell me what you see here, Mary. I stare at my reflection in the shaking mirror, clutching the sink for balance. I'm blind and wet, and my name is Mary, not Mim, and I've never been in a fight, never been on a boat, never quit a job, never been to Venice, never, never, never. The bottom drops out, and I'm down, on my side, floating in a strange, sudden weightlessness, as if in water or outer space. From far away, one, two, a thousand pleas for mercy, animal-like screams, rabid and seething for survival. A minute, an hour, a lifetime. There is no time. There are no things. I have no more things. I have only scraping metal, screaming voices, and death. And suddenly, my symphony of travel crescendos, achieving its rumbling, mighty end. The bus is still. On, off, on, off, on. The jaundiced light bulb flashes at random intervals. I lie on my side, staring straight into the now-cracked mirror. Like a joke with some sick punchline, my right eyelid is closed. For a moment, I am content to lie immobile, a cyclops among a thousand shatterings. Breath races through my lungs, veins, limbs, spreading like a virus to every corner of my body. It gathers strength, then at once rushes to my head. There is life in my life. To my left, the door hangs loosely by a hinge, unoccupied. The opening is narrow, but I squeeze under it into the main compartment of the bus. Despite the pain, I pull myself off the floor and look around. The Greyhound is tipped. It's a simmering stew of glass and blood and sewage and luggage, a cinematic devastation. Like the lights in the bathroom,
The cabin lights flicker on and off in irregular intervals. Some people are moving, some are moaning, and some aren't doing either. Carl is bleeding in about 6 places, administering CPR to one of the Japanese guys. I see Poncho Man help Amazon Blonde to her feet right where I'd been sitting. I stand and stare for I don't know how long, until an axe crashes through the left wall, formerly the roof of the bus. Firefighters crawl through the wreckage like ants, pulling limp bodies around their shoulders, administering first aid. 2 EMTs, one with acne and scraggly red hair, approach the limp body of a woman. The redhead leans over, puts his ear to the woman's chest. Straightening, he looks at his partner, shakes his head. Together, they hoist her from her seat, and that's when I see who it is. Arlene. My Arlene. I am Mary Iris Malone, and I am empty, cleaned the fuck out. All that's left is a fierce hunger for flight. I have to get out of here. I stumble forward, stepping on a yellow dash, then another and another. I'm walking on the highway, from inside the bus. The windows, once lining the sides of the Greyhound, are gone, replaced by wet blacktop. Seats are jutting out of the wall, row after row of them. I step over and around people, and it's impossible not to wonder which ones are dead and which ones are unconscious. The difference between stepping over a person and stepping over a body. The dam of my epiglottis cracks, then crumbles. I vomit on the ground in front of me. And I see it. Thing of things. Impossible, yet inevitable. Poking out from under a threadbare Philip K. Dick novel. The corner of Arlene's wooden box. Like a time capsule, it remains blissfully unaffected by the annihilation of the world around it. I pick it up, stagger the rest of the way through the bizarro bus. Through the jagged perforation of hacked metal, I step outside, transported from one dreamlike scene to another. The rain soaks through my hoodie in seconds, and at first all I can think is, I never even heard the sirens. I pull Arlene's box tight against my stomach and turn in a slow circle. A surreal panorama. Fire engines, ambulances, state troopers, and curious bystanders are gathered, rain or no rain, right in the middle of the highway. Behind us, the headlights of 1,000 cars go on for miles in complete deadlock. Amazon Blonde is being loaded into an ambulance. Jabba the Gut is going with her, probably for about 300 pounds worth of reasons. Here, says an EMT, draping her arm around my shoulder. Let me help. I'm fine, I say, pushing her off. She points to my knee, where a crimson stain has soaked through my jeans. So that was there before then, was it? She leads me into the back of an ambulance, out of the pouring rain, and treats my wound. Once done, she drapes a blanket across my shoulders, then jumps back into the wet wreckage without a word. People are rushing on and off the bus, some crying, some bleeding, some hugging. And I can't help but think that before all this happened, I probably would have gotten off in Cleveland in a day or so, and, other than Arlene, not given one thought to these people. But now they're really part of things, part of my life, written in the history of me. Arlene. Choking back a flood of tears, I pull her box out from under my blanket. What in the world am I going to do with you?
You okay, Missy?
Carl is towering over me like I don't know what. A tower of Carl, I suppose. Yeah, just a cut. I shiver and pull the blanket a little tighter, concealing Arlene's box. What happened?
Tire blew, he mumbles. I reported a recall back in Jackson, recommended we either change tires or take a different bus, but no one listened. No one ever listens.
A freaking men.
You were traveling alone, right?
He asks. Yeah, I say. Already called my dad, let him know what was going on. He said as long as I'm not hurt, I may as well go on to Cleveland. How's that work, by the way? Carl lights a cigarette, takes a long draw. God, he looks like a badass smoking in the rain.
I'll make arrangements. Whoever wants to can stay in a motel tonight, then we'll take a new bus in the morning. Everything will be paid for, of course.
He trails off and seems to be considering something.
Listen. You the driver? Interrupts the red-headed EMT.
He's shivering in the rain, holding a cell toward Carl. Before taking the call, Carl, like some muscly action hero, rips off a bottom section of his sopping wet t-shirt and hands it to me.
You got something on your face, Missy.
Oh my God. My war paint. Somehow it seems beyond appropriate that I stumbled through the ravaged bus with my face painted red. Mim the warrior princess. Battle survivor with a bloody wound to prove it. As Carl limps off to take his call, I wipe my face with his rainy t-shirt and study Arlene's box. Surprisingly heavy, it has one of those old-fashioned skeleton keyholes. The contents don't shake or rattle or anything, but they do shift as I move the box side to side. On the bottom, I find four letters carved deep in the wood. Ahab. Chapter 9. A Metamorphosis Completed. September 1. Late, yo. Dear Isabel, here is a drawing of my Greyhound bus, after tipping on the side of the highway and causing an all-around shitstorm from which I may never fully recover. Okay, so I suck at drawing, but that just happened to me. Ahem. Son of a bitch, it was totally catastrophic. Sorry, had to get that off my chest. Now, it would be easy for me to wallow in self-defeat or self-pity or self-doubt or 100 other selves, but I won't. I'm just going to write. I'm going to write, and that way I'll be okay. Let's start with a name. I'll write down this name, and it won't mean anything to you, but when you read it, know that it means something to me. The owner of the name died on that bus, and while I don't know her all that well, she was a friend, and those don't come easy. Not for me, anyway. She smelled like cookies and wore funny shoes and used words like pizzazz. Here's the name. Arlene. Okay. I'm okay. I'm headed to a motel right now in a van with about 12 other people. Our bus was full, but most of the passengers seemed uninterested in continuing their relationship with Greyhound. Relationship. That's exactly what it is. Hey, girl, I know I almost crushed you to death, but it was a one-time thing. I swear it'll never happen again. Greyhounds are pigs. Unfortunately, I don't have many options. Anyway, it takes more than a life before your eyes kill your elderly best friend type of bus accident to keep me from Cleveland. My objective is a bulwark never failing. Moving on. My war paint is reason number 5. Mom's favorite lipstick. The only article of makeup I've ever been interested in. Call it a cosmetic deficiency. The idea that this was abnormal hit early, around 3rd or 4th grade. A girl knows when she's being talked about, am I right? But I didn't care. I rolled with it. Abnormalities abound. That was my motto. Until it wasn't. In 8th grade, I joined the Ashland Blackhawks street hockey team. The league was a fledgling operation run by a throng of kids, meatheads mostly, looking for an excuse to punch someone. I was the only girl. 'Twas always thus. So they only rarely punched me. The team captain, who doubled as league referee, was this punk kid of about 15 named Bubba Shapiro. While other teams were called for high-sticking, clipping, cross-checking, and all manner of unsportsmanlike conduct, our team got off scot-free. Bubba looked exactly as you'd expect. Big, beefy. He even had a full-fledged beard, which at his age commanded enormous respect. Not for me so much, but, you know, the meatheads ate it up. One day, a kid named Chris York didn't show up for practice, and Bubba made an announcement.
Okay, guys. Chris came out at school today, so we're gonna have to push on without him.
I raised my hand and asked where Chris had come out of. The meatheads laughed. Bubba asked if I was an idiot, then said,
"He's a fudge packer, Mim. Queer bait. Brokeback mountaineer.
He's gay.
Again, everyone laughed. Again, I raised my hand. Sorry, but what does that have to do with hockey? Bubba rolled his eyes and explained that gays didn't like sports. Well, here's the thing. I never really liked sports either. The only reason I joined the team was that Dad said I would need some extracurriculars on my college applications. Malone males are notorious overachievers. This association between sports and sexual identity continued to nag at me, until one night, while Mom was doing her makeup, I asked how I would know if I were gay. Tell me, she said, putting the finishing touches on her mascara. How do you feel about Jack Dawson? I blushed and smiled. My eyes, I'm sure, took on a twinkling, otherworldly property. My parents had always been sticklers for film ratings, though I suspected Dad was the driving force behind this. And since Titanic was PG-13, I'd had to wait until, you guessed it, my 13th birthday. At which point, Mom and I watched it exclusively and repetitively. We'd seen it 29 times. Exactly, not approximately. While the story and special effects were achievements in their own right, it was no secret why we loved the movie. Leo DiCaprio as the noble Jack Dawson was just too yum for his own good. I swear I'm not one of those girls who oohs and ahs over weekly celebrity crushes is, but in the case of Leo, I simply cannot help myself. I'd be lying if I told you I don't think about that scene down by the furnaces in that old car. Blimey, it's hot in this van. Smiling, Mom reached for the makeup tray on her vanity. She grabbed the black tube with the shiny silver ring in the middle. This was her favorite lipstick, the kind she wore only on special occasions. Scoot in here, Mary. Let me show you a thing or two. For the next 20 minutes, I received my first and last makeover. I have no moral objections to makeup, you understand. It's just, I know me. And makeup isn't me. This, in addition to my edgy, hard-nosed, take-no-prisoner attitude, and I think I could have made a pretty decent lesbian. Not to pigeonhole the demographic. I'm sure there are plenty of lesbian softies out there, gobbling up tubs of ice cream and sobbing at the end of early 90s rom-coms. But when it's all said and done, I am Madam Winslet in that old car with Leo, not the other way around. And as simple as it sounds, I think understanding who you are and who you are not is the most important thing of all important things. So that's the setup. The teardown is a topic of substance and despair, if ever there was one. Or as Bubba Shapiro might say, unsportsmanlike conduct. But you really only need to know two things. First, I've been carrying around my mother's lipstick for a while now, occasionally using it to paint my face like some war-crazed chiefess preparing for battle. And second, it is vital that the lipstick be returned to its rightful owner. I have to go now, because we just pulled into the motel's parking lot. More reasons to follow. Signing off, Mary Iris DiCaprio. Mom hitchhiked through Europe when she was younger. I remember her talking about the hostels she stayed in and how they were complete dumps, but she didn't care. They had stories to tell, little pieces of the people who had stayed in them before, what they wore, what they ate, what they believed. Mom said she loved staying in a place where anything might have happened, even if nothing ever did. And she always ended her stories by saying, "Granted, they all smelled like a moth shoe, yeah?" God, I wish I could have known her back then, in her hitchhiking glory days. The young, fun now, 24/7. I stuff the stick figure journal in my bag and hop out of the van. "All righty," says Carl, limping from the front office of the Motel 6. Dude is a superhero. Bandaged and bruised and not one word of complaint. I suppose the streak continues. If this guy's not a true blue Carl, then I don't know a thing. He passes out keys with dangling bottle caps. Mine has the number 7 scrawled on top. "These are your room keys," he says. "Greyhound's gonna drop off a new bus overnight. I set up a 6:30 wake-up call for everyone tomorrow morning, so let's just meet back here at 7:30 on the dot. You don't show up, I'll assume you got another ride.
I ain't your mama. Got it?
One of the Japanese guys raises his hand. I think it's the one Carl just CPR'd on the bus. Excuse me, bus driver? He asks, without a trace of an accent. Where are we? Carl lights a cigarette, exhales out the side of his mouth.
Memphis. Just outside Graceland.
Everyone disperses, heading toward his or her respective rooms. I grab my bag with renewed spirit. Graceland. Home of my mother's all-time favorite artist. Undeniably, this is a good sign. Poncho Man, who apparently lost a shoe in the wreck as he's currently wearing one penny loafer and one too-big sneaker, winks at me as he turns toward his room.
Sleep tight, ma'am.
Go to hell, creep. On the way to my room, I spot a pharmacy across the street. It's one of those real classy joints where the light bulb in every other letter has gone dark. Instead of pharmacy, it reads P-A-M-C. Maybe it's the wreck, or the rush of blood from my leg wound, or the death of my friend. But I'm suddenly feeling impulsive and alive. I need change, and I need it now. I cross the empty street and enter P-A-M-C, surprised it's open this late. Between the elevator music and the sharp artificial lights, it feels like I just stepped onto a flying saucer. Apparently, my aliens love the dude who sings Never Gonna Give You Up, because, you know, obviously. An employee behind the checkout counter is filing her nails and humming along with the song.
Hey,
she says.
Hey, hair cutting shears?
Aisle 9.
She points a fiercely manicured fingernail. I hustle down aisle 9 and, as an afterthought, grab 4 packs of makeup remover. At the checkout counter, the girl blows her fingernails, rings me up.
Makeover?
She says.
Something like that.
Back across the street, I locate the room between 6 and 8. Hanging there with aplomb is a brass L. I twist the letter into the number 7, but it falls again. Too tired to care, I unlock the door with my bottle cap key and breathe in the sweet scent of a moth shoe. I wonder, what might have happened in this room? Elvis wrote my mother's all-time favorite song, Can't Help Falling in Love. A rogue beekeeper who insisted on the very freshest honey to go with his morning biscuits snuck in a hive. A rabbi questioned his faith. A whore turned her trick. A somebody did their something. In this room. I toss my JanSport under a rickety AC unit and pull the shears out of their plastic box. In the bathroom, I stare at my reflection in the mirror and visualize a new me. Maud Mim. Like Michelangelo to a block of stone, I see my lengthy mop of dark hair and know the end result before I begin. I snip with courage, purpose, urgency, styling my hair the way I've always wanted, but never had the stones to ask for. Edgy, chic, short in the back, then angled down into longer sides. The bob cut of all bob cuts. And the bangs. My God, the bangs! I leave them long, just barely out of my eyes, sharp and straight enough to give Anna Wintour a run for her money. With only one good eye, I have to double and triple check all the lines to make sure they're even. Once done, I stare at myself in the fluorescent light and finally feel like the girl I am. The girl who gets called to the principal's office, but hops a bus to Cleveland instead. The girl who survived a catastrophic accident. The girl who took matters into her own hands. Figuratively, literally, fucking finally. I feel more Mim than ever before. Chapter 10. Inventory. 7:42 looks blurry. 7:43 is a little clearer. 7:44? Groggy, I will myself out of bed. I've never really been a morning person, but waking up in yesterday's clothes makes me reconsider being a person altogether. I stumble across the room, push back a curtain. Well, there's a bus, so that's good. Though I don't see anyone around it, which probably means everyone's still asleep, which probably means some lazy bones down in the front office forgot our wake-up calls. I grab the receiver, press 0, and wait. After exactly 32 rings, Yes, I count, and yes, I wait that long, because really, once it passes 10 rings, it becomes a game of how many rings can we get to before someone finally picks up the GD telephone. I hear the soft click of someone picking up on the other end. Except, no hello or anything. Whoever it is, they don't say a word. Hello? I say.
Yes, hi.
The guy has a thick accent of indeterminate origin. Gun to my head, I would guess Estonian. I carry the phone over to the dresser mirror and study my new haircut.
Hi.
Yes, hi.
Well, this is weird. Oh, hi, yes. I was with the group of about 12 or so that came in last night after our bus got demolished on 55. I am met with complete silence. This Estonian guy could use a lesson or two in telephone etiquette, though I suppose it should come from someone who speaks his native tongue. Thank God I was born with an unending supply of Malone stick-to-itiveness. Well, last night, Carl, that's our bus driver, he set up a 6:30 wake-up call, and I never got one. Silence. I'd hate for everyone to miss the bus, so to speak. Ha! Silence. I clear my throat. Finally, on the other end.
Yes, hi, okay.
Click. Turning from the mirror, I hang up but let my hand rest on the phone for a second. I should give Dad a ring, just to let him know I'm okay. Out of curiosity, I unzip my backpack and pull out my cell phone. 14 missed calls from Kathy. Blimey, that's a lot of shit music. A pang of something, injury maybe, settles in my stomach. When I see that Dad only called once. I've been gone overnight now, and he's called once. And there's a voicemail. I dial the code and listen.
Mim, it's... Throat clear. It's me. I mean, it's Dad.
Sigh.
Mim, where are you? We're all sort of freaked here.
Short pause.
Principal Schwartz says you've been skipping school. If you're worried we're mad, we're...
Long pause. In the background, I hear Kathy say something. Dad responds. He must have covered the phone because I can't make out any of it.
Listen, he says, sighing again. About the other night, I hate the way that conversation ended. You have to understand, no matter what happened between me and your mom, I snap the phone shut.
If Dad wants to discuss the breaking news, he's gonna have to find me first. Though I wouldn't put it past Kathy to call the cops, which could seriously complicate things. Maybe if I just let them know I'm okay without telling them what I'm doing. I think through the phrasing first, then open the internet browser on my phone. The thing is ancient, and while Wi-Fi is possible, it certainly isn't cheap. Though right now, that only serves as an extra incentive. After a few seconds, I'm connected. I open my Facebook profile and update my status. Not dead. Not abducted, though aliens are, as always, welcome. You'll hear from me when you hear from me. I reread the wording a few times, press post, then chuck the phone in my bag. After a quick shower, I pull on a clean tee and underwear, cursing myself for not bringing another pair of pants. I slip on the same hoodie and bloodstained jeans, then take a closer look at Arlene's box. The brass lock, the reddish wood. All of it is in fine condition, wholly unaffected by the crash. I have no idea why I picked it up, except leaving it there in the middle of everything just didn't seem right. It obviously meant a lot to Arlene, but it's not like I can get it to her nephew, the preposterous swimmer-turned-successful gas station operator Ahab. I don't even know the guy's last name. Or Arlene's, for that matter. Pushing back the Arlene-shaped knot in my throat, I tuck the box away and pull out my bottle of abilitol. Like a siren, it tempts me with whispered promises of the ever-elusive, normal life. If I were home right now, this would be Dad's shining moment, the one in which he eagerly explains the pill's function. He always used the same tone when he talked meds, a slick salesman-slash-drug-dealer-slash-nerdy-dad combo.
It balances the serotonin levels, Mim. It'll adjust your brain chemicals, dopamine and that sort of thing. It just evens everything out so you can live a normal life.
I always expected him to end those speeches with, "Everybody's doing it, man!" Peer pressure is one thing, but when your dad's the pusher, it's something else entirely. The bottle stares up at me now as only a bottle of prescription meds can do, redefining the art of seduction. I stare right back.
Mary Malone, aripaprazole, 10 milligrams, take one tablet by mouth daily. Refills, no. Quantity, 45. Dr. B. Wilson. And the memories tumble. Antoine knocks over ink splotches, knocks over Bach, knocks over, tell me what you see here, Mary. Knocks over, knocks over, knocks over. I tip a single pink pill into my palm and hold it up to my good eye. Small, strong, tempting. One ring to rule them all, I whisper, immediately regretting it. Sometimes things are more embarrassing when you're alone. I guess when no one's around to hear your stupidity, you're forced to bear the brunt of it. I grab my new pair of shears from the dresser and, in the spirit of utopian mutiny, cut the pill in half. I'd expected the thing to shatter, but it doesn't. It's a clean cut right down the middle. I grab my water bottle, swallow one half of the pill, and toss the other in the trash. All packed up, I sit by the window and pull my mother's sixth letter from my pocket. Softened by sweat and rain, the ink is faded a bit, though not beyond recognition. Think of what's best for her. Please reconsider. Back on the bus, I'd been too worked up to notice the missing apostrophe. I picture Mom writing this, impetuous and angry. She'd have to be to make this kind of... The phone rings. I look at the receiver. It rings again. And again. Surely not. I cross the room and pull the phone from its cradle, daring this to be the call I think it is. Hello?
Yes, hi. This is your wake-up call.
Click. There are times when I absolutely, 110%, without a doubt, have to laugh at a thing. Because if I don't, that same thing will make me go stark raving bananas. I hang up the phone and laugh until I cry. Chapter 11. Hyena versus Gazelle. After we board the new bus, much nicer than the old one, Carl hands everyone an envelope full of vouchers and coupons. Not only do I get a row to myself, I find one with an outlet just below the window. After plugging in my phone, I stow my JanSport in the overhead compartment and spend the next hour or so watching the kid across the aisle eat deli ham straight from a Ziploc. In and of itself, this isn't noteworthy, but as the kid looks dead on like a young Frodo Baggins, it is, I believe, the worthiest of all notes.
We shall go through the mines of Moria, but first, let us replenish our energy with finely sliced deli meats. Eat, drink, be merry, elves, ham, huzzah!
Exactly why I don't have a boyfriend, I whisper, turning to the window. Because you've referenced Lord of the Rings twice before lunch, or because you're talking to yourself? I have to admit, I've got me there. A couple of hours later, we pull off for lunch at a remote exit. Carl gets on the mic and goes through his spiel about not leaving valuables on the bus, and how much time we have at this stop.
If you ain't back in 45 minutes, I'll assume you found yourself a ride. We're an hour from Nashville, and this time, we'll be on time. I ain't your mama, and I will leave without you.
Attaboy, Carl. Once off the bus, someone asks about the restaurant, to which Carl points at a sign over a nearby gas station door. Ed's Place. Chicken and gas. The image in my brain is unsettling, to say the least. Ed, a disgruntled Vietnam vet, stands over a stove with two ashy cigarillos hanging from either side of his mouth. He's stirring a giant pot of his famous chicken petroleum soup. It makes sense, too, because where I've had good luck with Carl's, I've never met a single Ed I didn't want to ninja to death. They're scoundrels through and through. I enter Ed's Place not with an attitude of optimism, but with an attitude of ninjaism. There are four tables, each with checkered paper tablecloths. I wait until Poncho Man sits, then pick the table farthest from him. Unfortunately, they're all pretty close together.
Mim, he whispers.
Pointing to my hair, he gives a thumbs up.
Looks great.
I throw on my most sarcastic smile, give him a thumbs up, and slowly raise my middle finger. A bald man with a biker beard and apron hobbles over to Poncho Man's table and greets him by name.
Hey, Joe, want the regular?
Poncho Man smiles, nods, then carries on a short, albeit jovial-looking conversation with the guy. He's been here before. I don't have a chance to process this information fully before the bald biker beard is at our table taking drink orders. What kind of coffee do you have? I ask.
What kind, says the waiter, only he says it like, wit canned.
Yeah, I mean, Ethiopian, Kona. It's not Colombian, is it? Under his beard, the waiter's jaws are chomping something, presumably a piece of gum. After a few uncomfortable seconds of silence, I spot the name sewn on the shirt pocket. Ed. And all is right with the world. Never mind, I sigh. I'll just have a chicken sandwich, please.
Ain't got chicken sandwich.
I choose a smile over a judo chop. The subtitle of your establishment indicates otherwise. He raises an eyebrow, chomps, says nothing. Okay, fine, I say. Burger?
What do you want to drink?
He asks. Orange soda, please.
We got grape, we got Coke, we got milk.
Milk, really? I hate this place. Fine, I'll have grape soda, I guess. Ed goes around the table, takes everyone's order, then shuffles off. In order to avoid the uncomfortable nearness of strangers, I thumb through the thick envelope of vouchers from Greyhound. One coupon offers a half-price massage at some mall in Topeka. The next is for a free go-kart ride at a place called the Dayton 500. The only coupons of any real value are 3 free nights at a Holiday Inn, a $15 gift card to Cracker Barrel, and a few Greyhound vouchers. Fair trade, I suppose, for almost murdering us. After maybe 10 minutes, a tray of food crashes into the middle of the table. Ed leans over my shoulder, his beard brushing my face, and tosses a plate at each person in turn, announcing the orders as he goes. And last but not least, he looks down at me, not with a twinkle in his eye, but a twinkle in his voice. A gourmet burger for the little lady, and a milk to wash it down.
I didn't order...
Bon appetit! He says, hobbling away with a maniacal laugh. I poke at the burger, which could probably double as a hockey puck. Choking down half of it with the milk, I push my plate away. I lead in Nashville. Carl announces a 15-minute warning. I grab my bag and follow a long hallway toward the back of Ed's place. The restroom is a two-staller with a filthy sink, foggy mirror, and wallpaper of creative expletives. I deadbolt the door, hang my bag on a hook, and, careful not to touch anything, pee in record time. After washing my hands, I unzip my bag, and just as I'm about to add the vouchers to Kathy's coffee can, I hear it. A cough. Just one. Quiet. Timid, almost, but definitely a cough. Cash in hand, I peek underneath the stall divider. There, in the second stall, one penny loafer, one too big sneaker. What the hell? Slowly the shoes shift and the door swings open. Poncho Man smiles at me, briefly glancing at the cash in my hand. Hello, Mim. Still kneeling, I remain frozen, reduced to the role of busty blonde in my own slasher. What are you doing in here? I ask. His leg brushes my knee as he steps to the faucet and runs his hands under the water. Thinking back, I don't remember a flush.
Oh, I find the ladies' room to be much more serene. You should see the men's room. Makes this dump look like the Ritz.
He wipes his hands on his poncho, then turns toward me and tilts his head.
I meant what I said, Mim. Your haircut is beautiful. And also sort of inevitable. Is that the right word?
Go, Mary, now. I regain motion, stuff everything back in my bag, and start for the door. I'm leaving. He steps in front of it, blocking me in.
Not yet.
Breathe, Mary.
I push my bangs out of my eyes, push the panic down, push, push, push.
I'll scream, I say.
I'll tell on you.
I flinch.
You'll what?
I overheard your little convo with Ed out there. You wouldn't drink Hills Brothers.